From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Enter the Chicken, a talk with journalist Burkhard Bilger about the secret world of cockfighting. He's written about it in his new book on clandestine Southern traditions. Also, film director Whit Stillman, he's making his debut as a novelist with his new book, The Last Days of Disco, with cocktails at Petrosian afterwards. It's a follow-up to his film, The Last Days of Disco. And this is Spinal Tap, the mock documentary about a heavy metal band, is back in theaters, and new editions have been released on DVD and VHS. We'll hear from Christopher Guest, who co-wrote and co-starred in the film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cockfighting is a blood sport in which chickens fight it out while people make bets. Because it's illegal in many places, and frowned upon even in some places where it is legal, the culture around it is somewhat secretive. My guest, Burkhard Bilger, wrote a fascinating article about cockfighting, what the sport is like today, its history, and what it says about our culture. That article is published in his new book, Noodling for Flatheads. It's a collection of pieces about clandestine Southern traditions. He grew up in Oklahoma and now lives in Brooklyn. He's a senior editor at Discover Magazine. I spoke with Bilger last year when his cockfighting article was first published in Harper's Magazine. Now, I've never seen a cockfight, and I imagine a lot of our listeners haven't seen one either. So why don't we get to a description of what a typical cockfight is like, if there is such a thing as a typical cockfight. Perhaps you can describe one of the cockfights you saw at the Red Rooster in Louisiana.
Well, the Red Rooster is a rickety little building in the middle of nowhere next to Maurice, Louisiana. It doesn't look like anything from the outside. There's barely even a sign. You go inside, and it's kind of all plywood, and everything's not square, and there's a little concession stand, and you walk in and you see kind of this miniature Thunderdome. It's this amphitheater of seats, kind of rickety benches. And the middle is this enormous two-story octagonal cage, which is made out of chicken wire. And it's elevated off the ground, and it's completely enclosed. And that's for a certain kind of Cuban cockfight where they just put the chickens in and leave, and they consider it the most natural cockfighting. But anyway, it's enclosed mainly to protect the spectators from the birds, which are wearing these knives on their heels in most cases. So the two handlers come in, and there's a referee in the middle who's wearing black and white stripes. And the handlers have to hold their chickens very tight in their arms because they're already pumped up. A lot of them get testosterone injections or digitalis to make their hearts race or any number of things to get them up for the game fight. And so they're really raging to go at each other. And the two handlers will stand side by side and kind of sway toward each other and let their chickens peck at each other for a while and get their dander up, so to speak. And then they'll put them behind two lines that are a few feet apart made out of cornmeal that are laid in the sandy floor of this cage. The referee stands in the middle and he'll say, "Pit." And then the handlers will let their chickens go. Up until then, it's all pretty straightforward and even-paced, but as soon as they go, I mean, the chickens move at 1,000 times the pace of everybody else in the room. I mean, it's like warp speed compared to everything. And all you see is this huge flurry of feathers and slashing talons. And for a newcomer like I was the first time I saw one, it's almost impossible to see what's going on. But the people who really know what's going on and have kind of accustomed their eyes to it can see, you know, what's happening is that the roosters are jumping up and dipping their tails down toward the ground and then spinning their talons with these knives that are attached to the back of their heels down in a kind of a windmill pattern at each other. And if they're lucky, one of them will strike, you know, in the head or the eye or in the neck, and then they'll fall down again and the whole thing starts over again.
Now, what are the rules of cockfighting compared, say, to the rules of boxing?
In some ways, they're the same. You know, they're rounds. Every time two chickens get tangled up, if their spurs or their gaffs get tangled in each other, they separate them, and the referee comes in there and puts them apart. And And in some places, like in Bali, they'll drop a coconut, a pierced coconut, into a tub of water. And the time it takes for that coconut to sink to the ground, the chickens get to recuperate. And just like handlers in a boxing match, the cockfight handlers will take the chicken and talk to him and rub him and wash him off. And sometimes they'll stick his whole head in their mouth and suck the blood out or even spit into his beak to give him some refreshment. So in some ways, it looks like a boxing match. What's different is that a boxing match obviously has rules of sportsmanship. You know, you can't do rabbit punches and so forth. But a cockfight, there isn't any. It's once they're in the pit and they're going, it's no holds barred.
Do they fight to the death?
Yeah, they always fight. I mean, they don't necessarily fight to the death. If a chicken dies and the other one is won. But essentially, they fight until one of the chickens dies or one of them runs away or refuses to fight anymore.
Now, are there ways of playing dirty within cockfighting? I mean, you've told us what the basic rules are. Are there...
Oh, there are innumerable ways to play dirty. I mean, the people in Louisiana I talked to said that that never happens. But there are a lot of kind of ingrained rituals around cockfighting just to prevent that. For instance, in Venezuela, on the island of Margarita, people there are famous for using stingray poison and putting that on the blades of their cocks before a fight. Or they'll throw poison into chicken's food. Or in the Philippines, you know, I've read that sometimes handlers have been known, while the other handler is looking, they'll reach over and just snap a little bone in another cock's back, you know, tiny bone, just to cripple him a little bit. There's one famous story from the Philippines of, you know, a local mayor went to visit another district, and he went to a big cockfighting ring. And Philippines cockfighting is enormous. It's really the national sport, and it affects local politics and all this kind of thing. And the mayor went to visit another cockpit and had his own chicken, and he was fighting it, and the chicken was losing. And the mayor just jumped into the ring, pulled out his .45, and blasted the other chicken out of the ring. And people said, "What are you doing? This is cheating." He goes, "Well, no, my chicken didn't lose. He was never killed by the other chicken." And, of course, he had 10 bodyguards with him, heavily armed, and everybody said, "Well, you're right. Actually, that's new. It's a new wrinkle. I never noticed that before." So there's a lot of ways to cheat.
Now, what's the state of cockfighting in America? I imagine that in some places it's very controversial. How do the sides typically break down?
It tends to be, I mean, it's hard to say, because the natural answer to that would be animal rights activists on the one hand and cockfighters on the other. It's kind of deceptive, because in some ways, in a place like Louisiana, for instance, you know, there are a lot of congressmen who are pro-cockfighting, who think of it as a real Louisiana tradition and think that if you get rid of it, you're getting rid of something like the Mardi Gras. I mean, I had a friend who I met there, an academic, who said, you know, they'll sooner get rid of Little League than they'll get rid of cockfighting in Louisiana. But it tends to be animal rights activists tend to be the goads to get the laws passed. And the fact of the matter is, for the most part, if you can get a state petition that says, "Do you agree with cockfighting?" almost anyone will say no. And so that tends to be, has been the best mechanism for outlawing in this country.
Yeah, so, you know, the cockfighting is very controversial. You weren't used to going to cockfights. Give us a little bit of what the atmosphere was like in the places that you went to. I mean, is it a real, like, bloodlust type of sport?
Well, for some people it is, I'm sure. I mean, I think the atmosphere varies from the small pits to the big pits. I mean, when I went originally the first time, I went to that brush pit, Red Rooster, at midnight, and it was a thunderstorm, and I was terrified because I'd heard cockfighting always comes with drug sales and gambling and all kinds of nefarious activity, and that if you go there, you're among bad apples and all this kind of thing. So I originally was fairly frightened, and I get there, of course, and it's completely the opposite. In the small pits, the atmosphere is amazingly homey. I mean, you get there, and the night I went, it was, by the time I got there, it was about 1 a.m, and there were two mothers nursing their babies right next to that big cage. There were toddlers running up and down the aisles. There were teenagers loitering around sipping Cokes. And it was very much, you know, family night. It was like going to a PTA meeting. It was very weird. And there, I would say, most people kind of went just for that. They went because, well, this is what everybody did on a Friday night or a Saturday night, and they like to be together. I talked to a sociologist later who said that cockfighters are kind of a frozen demographic. They're like the American from the 40s or 50s still living in these little tiny pockets. You know, they tend to be rural and small town and church going and, you know, American as apple pie. So that's the small pits. But the big pits, those are a completely different scene. I mean, I went to one where there were 900 chickens fought in one night and there was a $40,000 purse. And, you know, people drove from hundreds of miles around. They paid $16 to sit there. And that was really a gambling scene. It was, people really didn't care about the chickens. They came with a lot of money. They wanted to see their chickens win. They wanted to leave with a lot of money. And it was also fairly, I mean, 900 chickens in a day. You can imagine there's blood everywhere. There are chickens by the end of the night. There are just broken chickens overflowing out of the trash cans, lying in the aisles. They tend to be very rickety structures because no one really trusts that cockfighting will be legal for very long. So they are these kind of claustrophobic, poorly built, you know, fire trap buildings with hundreds of people screaming out their bets. It's not a really pleasant atmosphere.
My guest is Burkhardt Bilger. His article about cockfighting is published in his new book, Noodling for Flatheads. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Burkhardt Bilger. We're talking about cockfighting, one of the subjects he writes about in his new book, Noodling for Flatheads.
Cockfighting sounds so, grotesque and violent. And you write that our forefathers were cockfighters. Jefferson had gamecocks. You say Andrew Jackson was fighting cocks on the White House carpet. That Lincoln was a former cockfighting referee. So this whole, American history of cockfighting, huh?
I mean, cockfighting, you know, there was a time when it was called one of the most fashionable amusements of American culture. It was the national pastime for a while in the 19th century. It was extremely popular. Not just those guys, but Grover Cleveland fought gamecocks. Woodrow Wilson gave plaques to cockfighters in the White House. There's even secondhand stories that Ronald Reagan's ranch used to have cockfights in his ranch houses. I mean, it's almost like a Thomas Pynchon novel. It's a secret history. If you start looking at cockfighting, it threads its way all through American history. But it was a mainstream amusement for most of the 18th and 19th century. And in England before that, clergymen used to stage cockfights and give prayer books as awards to the best cockfights. I mean, Henry VIII had a huge, sumptuous cockpit built with special gilded cock cages for all his lords and so forth. So it has this kind of prestigious history that got abruptly cut in this country around the beginning of the 20th century.
And what changed then?
I think two things. It kind of got attacked from two angles. One is the what they call the anthropocentric angle, which is said basically that cockfighting is bad for people, that you go to a cockfight and you're with a bad element and you're engaging in bloodlust and you're emphasizing all the worst human attributes. And the other one, of course, was the rise of the Humane Society movement in the end of the 19th century, which just gradually. I mean, that was really much weaker than the former argument, but it ended up being the one that really killed cockfighting.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were interested in the ethics of cockfighting, so you spent some time at a regular chicken farm, the kind of chicken farm where chickens are born to lay eggs for our breakfast and to create chicken meat for our dinners. And compare the conditions that you found on that big chicken farm with the conditions that you found on a farm that raises chickens for cockfighting, or roosters, I should say.
Yeah. Well, the farms where they raise cocks tend to be, I mean, by chicken terms, you know, they're like luxury resorts, which isn't to mean that, you know, that there's bronze and gilt everywhere, but every cock has his own cage, this little conical cage with a long walking strip in front of it. They have these tenders that come by and rub them down every morning and give them special feeds and exercise them. And if they get too antsy, they'll bring in these plump little pullets and have them kind of work out their desires with another chicken. It's just, it really is. If you're a chicken, you want to be a cock, a game cock, because... And they'll live much longer. They'll live 1 to 3 years in most cases. Now, you compare that to a chicken factory. I mean, I went to one in Little Rock, which is a Tyson chicken factory. And Tyson is no worse than any of the others. They have a very, very efficient chicken-raising business, and we all reap the benefits of that. I mean, chicken used to be the luxury meat in this country. It was more expensive than lobster. It was more expensive than filet mignon. When people said a chicken in every pot, it was because it was considered so outrageous that would ever come true. And it has come true, and it's come true because of the way people like Tyson raise chickens. It would take 16 weeks for a chicken to reach 2 pounds. Now it takes 6 weeks for a chicken to reach 4 pounds. I mean, genetics and nutrition and just raising methods have increased incredibly. But of course, the dark side of that is the life of the chicken. I mean, you go to a Tyson factory, and there are these enormous sheds, and they're just tens of thousands of chickens crammed into a shed together, shoulder to shoulder. They spend 6 weeks in there, and that's not so bad, really, because it's kind of social, at least. But that's their life. That's the best part. Then they get crammed into trucks, 7,000 at a time, carried to this factory, and dumped on this enormous conveyor belt, which is a few feet wide, which just rolls them up into the maw of this factory. And they get there, and I mean, the guy who led the tour, I'm so grateful that he even took me there, because most chicken PR people don't want you to see these factories. They just want to keep you away. But he reluctantly agreed to take me into the killing zone. And you go in there, and it's almost pitch black except for some black lights. And the workers have top 40 music screaming, and the machinery is incredibly loud. And the workers just pluck these chickens off this conveyor belt and reach them up very quickly and hang them by their feet from this running chain that whips by overhead very fast. And so the chickens are hanging upside down. They get whipped over into the next room. And that room is a weird room. It's lit kind of like, I mean, the one I saw was lit like a Dutch painting, you know, just one light bulb in the corner. And the chickens come hurtling through, and they come into these mechanical bottlenecks where their heads get squeezed together and an electric shock gets jabbed into their head and they get stunned. And then as they hang limp, a rotary saw comes and slashes their head off. And, you know, a few chickens will raise their heads and get away, but then somebody reaches over and cuts their throat with a knife. So it's, you know, if you had your choice between dying in a battle in a cage or dying that way, I think it'd be a fairly hard choice, but most people would probably pick the cockfight.
The article that you wrote for Harper's on cockfighting is actually part of a larger project that you're doing. You're writing a book on clandestine Southern traditions. What do you mean by that?
I mean, I'm interested in traditions that are like cockfighting that tend to be rural and have a lot of history to them and are interesting in that sense. Is they're a rich subculture, and they tend to be outlawed or illegal. And the reason, more often than not, tends to be say a lot about our values and how they've changed in the course of, you know, American history. Another example is a thing called noodling, which I wrote a piece for The Atlantic about. And that's where you hand grab catfish with your hands. You just, in the spring, you walk along a riverbank and you stick your hand into a hole and then you wiggle your fingers. And if a catfish is in there nesting, he'll bite your hand. And so you'll jam your arm down its throat and pull up this fish on your forearm, and it's a way of catching catfish that is very old, and the Indians did it, and it's been around forever, but it's outlawed in almost every state. And the reason is people say it's unsporting. And again, it's a kind of an example. It doesn't really make any sense to say it's unsporting. It doesn't make any ecological sense. It's just kind of a judgment we pass as a culture because our values are urban and no longer rural. And so I'm interested in traditions like that, that kind of put those things in perspective.
Your official paragraph-long biography says that you have a coonhound named Hattie. Is the coonhound part of your interest in these clandestine Southern practices?
Oh yeah, she's kind of she was the goad who got me into it. I think when I was living in Boston, I was kind of nostalgic for my Oklahoma roots, and I decided to buy a coon hound, which I'd always seen on country roads and so forth. So I started to look around for one. I couldn't find one. And so I made a lot of calls and finally discovered a guy who bred blue tick coon hounds in Massachusetts. And I went to visit him, and I told him that I wanted to buy a red bone coon hound. And he went, and he lifted up his hand. He said, just a second. He went in his house, and he came back with American Cooner magazine, which is just the weirdest magazine I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it's an inch thick. It has 100,000 subscribers. It's full of pictures of dogs jumping up trees and advertisements for chilled semen. You know, everybody's shipping their chilled semen all over the country. It's like, well, where did this come from? And since when is there this huge coon hunting subculture? And so I started to make calls, and I ended up writing a piece on coon hunting, and that's going to be one of the chapters in the book. And it really kind of introduced me to the interest. I mean, coon hunting is another thing. People go out in the middle of the night, every night. I mean, I hung out with a woman who coon hunts 350 nights a year. And every night at midnight, she goes into the woods and she stays out till 5 in the morning. And most of that time, she's just standing in the forest listening to her dog run down raccoons. It's just the strangest sport in the world. And yet it's wonderful. And it's once you get into it, it's kind of addictive.
So now that you're deep into all these hidden Southern practices, you're living in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, yeah, the epicenter of clandestine Southern traditions.
Yeah, absolutely. So I imagine there's a fair amount of cockfighting there.
There's a huge amount of cockfighting in Brooklyn. I mean, there's so many Latin and Asian immigrants. And, you know, of course, there's Santa Ria and so forth. So there's plenty of chickens around.
Well, Burkhard, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Burkhard Bilger's article about cockfighting is published in his new book, Noodling for Flatheads, about clandestine Southern traditions. Our interview was recorded last year when his cockfighting article was first published in Harper's Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a spoof of heavy metal and an homage to disco. We hear from Whit Stillman. His new novel is a follow-up to his movie The Last Days of Disco. And Christopher Guest talks about This is Spinal Tap, the mock documentary about a heavy metal band, which he co-wrote and co-starred in. It's back in theaters. The elves are dressed in leather and the angels are in chains. The sugar plums are rancid and the stockings are in flames. There's a demon in my belly and a gremlin in my brain. There's someone up the chimney hole. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the movie The Last Days of Disco, screenwriter and director Whit Stillman paid homage to the dance music that many people despised. Now Stillman is touring the country, reading from his new novel, which expands on the story he told in the film. The book is called The Last Days of Disco, with cocktails at Petrosian's afterwards. This romantic comedy is set in the early 80s and follows a group of young single people as they look for friendship and love at an exclusive Manhattan disco. In this scene from the film, a young assistant DA is talking with a friend at a coffee shop about why he loves disco.
I was just starting law school when the first up-tempo Philadelphia International hits broke. Some people don't consider that disco because it's good, but I remember feeling absolutely electrified.
You feel electrified often.
No, but this was different. I loved the idea that there'd be all these great places for people to go dancing after the terrible social wasteland of our college years.
Oof. You've been to a lot of discos?
No. In fact, practically none. For me, law school wasn't easy, and I haven't had much of a social life since coming to the city either, but I still consider myself a loyal adherent to the disco movement.
It's a movement?
Sort of. What I found terribly encouraging was the idea that when the time in life came to have a social life, there'd be all these great places for people to go to, because, as you'll remember, for many years, there were none. What I didn't realize is that it gets so impossible to get into.
Filmmaker Whit Stillman started going to dance clubs when he was a teenager, traveling in Europe in the late 60s, and picked up with them again here in the late 70s. Stillman considers the film The Last Days of Disco the conclusion of a trilogy about young single people and their group social life. Metropolitan was about debutantes and their escorts, Barcelona about Americans living in Europe. I spoke with Stillman when The Last Days of Disco was released in 1998, and he told me why he wanted to set a story in the disco era.
It was when I was in the throes of trying to find the right significant other. The way the characters in the film are, it was the sort of apex of our single social life. And I think it's rare in our country when we have places and moments when groups of young people congregate after college. I think we often live sort of solitary social lives where there's a date and dinner and a movie or a party. But a place where you can semi-anonymously go and run into people you like or meet new people is not something we always have.
It's the ambition of some of the characters in The Last Days of Disco just to be admitted to the club. And some of the characters are so angry and insulted that they can't get in, or even worse, that they've been thrown out, that they compare the bouncers and the guards to the Nazis. I'm thinking you must have felt ambivalent about a club scene where only the beautiful people get let in, where you have to, like, look right and be the right age and so on in order to just get admitted.
Well, I think it was more of extremes, so you could sort of play the extremes. And also, I think there are times when it wasn't very hard to get in. I think if you go the peak time when everyone else is, it's like a traffic jam, and you don't get in. But there were ways of slipping in different moments, you know, early in the evening, very late in the evening, the back door, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that it was justified in some of those clubs because it really worked in the sense they created a party atmosphere inside. Unfortunately, the party invitation list was done right at the door. So it was cruel that way. But it was very easy also to pretend that I didn't really want to go. And, you know, maybe it's better we go to Rex's and have a drink. And so, I mean, I don't think we should read too much into the rejection. For one of the characters, it's part of his career. He feels that if he doesn't get people into the club, he's going to lose his job because there's been a merger in his ad agency. We don't really talk about that. He's the last of the old regime. And he feels if he can't get the clients in or the top brass of the agency in, they're going to let him go.
Whit Stillman, are you a good dancer?
I think so. But it was pretty embarrassing in our premiere, and there were a lot of photographers, and they wanted me to dance with Chloe and Tara Subkoff, and I'm afraid whatever skills I had disappeared at that moment.
Is there a connection between the disco era and the debutante era for you? And by that, I mean your first film, Metropolitan, is about a group of people in their late teens, is that about right? Mid-teens?
Yeah, it's kind of specific in Metropolitan because most of the women would be between 17 and 19, and the guys would be that age plus a little bit older. And so there might be a two-year age difference between the guys and the women.
And the story is about debutantes and their male escorts. And I'm wondering if the friends you had in like the Deb days are the same friends you had in the disco days, or whether those were two completely separate groups of people.
Well, they were different people from the same subgroup. There was some overlap. And I think, you know, it's a good question because there was, I think, the feeling of recreating the Deb days in the discos. And there was a very strong element of that in the Red Velvet Rope clubs. I think people, if they had to go to some dress-up party where they had to wear a black tie, they would think, well, let's try to go to studio afterwards because maybe we'll get in if we're dressed this way. So we now become sort of special and extreme because we're all dressed up and maybe we'll be able to get in. And so I think there's a feeling of that same alcohol-fueled, heightened romance, experience of life, late at night. You lose sort of perspective in a nice way and can have a very good time.
Now, you make films about the children of the privileged class.
No, they're not a privileged class.
They're not a privileged class.
We got rid of privileges in this country, I think, in 1810. I think the last ancestral estates were voted out by the New York State Legislature around then. James Fenimore Cooper was very upset about it.
To put it in other words, one of your characters does, you make films about the children of the haute bourgeoisie.
Okay.
You like that better?
I like someone who commented on the penuriousness of the characters, that they're not necessarily rich, that maybe there was money several generations ago or the memory of money, and now it's about something else.
Do you think that people who are from that class, either the upper class or that just have the memory of money, do you think that they're treated badly in pop culture?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really like they're going to put them in camps and re-educate them. And it's really shocking. I didn't see the entire movie Titanic, but I think it was pretty immoral.
Pretty immoral?
Yeah, I think it was, because they're essentially dancing on the grave of very honorable people. The people on the ship, a lot of them behaved very, very well. They were very honorable in the way they died. And to have some, you know, jerk from Hollywood maligning those people, I think was really disgraceful.
Oh, maligning them because they were rich.
Yeah, that kind of misrepresentation. I mean, I think it's hateful when people destroy the humanity of other people based on externals. And I think it's hateful when it's done for reasons of race or ethnic group. But also, I think people feel that they have a free pass when it's class. So if they can identify the people as a class in the upper range of the spectrum, then they're free to hate and, you know, kill yuppie scum, which is, you know, kind of a joke when people write, kill yuppie scum. But I think there's a lot of that emotion floating out there.
Now, I think your grandfather was president of First National City Bank, which is now Citibank. Your father was a lawyer and Democratic County chair.
My grandfather actually was a research physician. He worked at the Rockefeller Institute.
Oh.
He was a doctor, and I think a forming influence in his life was the Spanish flu epidemic after the war that killed so many people. So he spent his life researching that. And his father was the president of Citibank back then.
I see.
So it was my great-grandfather.
Did you have what you've described as the memory of money in your family?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And having a divorce in the family also meant that there's more of a separation. And for me, it's very positive because I think you get in very bad habits of mind when there's inherited money in a family. I think it's a very negative thing for people to deal with. And being released from that when my parents got divorced, I think was a positive growth experience, as we'd say.
Were you like downwardly mobile after the divorce?
I was very dramatically downwardly mobile.
What was the experience like of having the culture and worldview of a class that you no longer had the money to fit into?
Well, I'm not sure if there is a culture and worldview of the class. I mean, it's a grab bag of all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I think what separates Tobacco Road from Park Avenue is sometimes very thin. And I think that the upper middle class is actually much more interesting and amusing and sort of pathetic than would be represented in a James Cameron movie. I think there's a lot of the lost souls who have enough money from some family connection never really to take the right chances and to touch bottom and to kind of build their own life and their own careers. They're sort of companies that don't really exist and jobs that are kind of mythical. And I admire the will and the dedication of those people who can rise up beyond a trust fund to do creative, productive things, even though there's this huge incentive for them to live in a kind of a world of illusion where they just keep up appearances and try to sound interesting.
My guest is Whit Stillman. He's written a new novel that expands on his movie, The Last Days of Disco. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1998 interview with Whit Stillman, recorded after the release of his film, The Last Days of Disco. He's just adapted the movie into a novel called The Last Days of Disco, with cocktails at Petrosian afterwards. One of the characters in Metropolitan, your movie about debutantes and their escorts, has to rent a tuxedo and wear a shabby raincoat over it instead of a Brooks Brothers overcoat. Were you in that position?
I was. I mean, there was actually probably, you know, more resources than that character had. But that was the psychological feeling. That was exactly how it felt. And what I think I liked about it was that rather than just being the kind of person going on family vacations, just tagging along with my family, I was in a situation where it was incumbent on me, I think, to make friends and to social climb, essentially, that I would be the friend who'd go along on the vacation, the cousin who'd be brought along as sort of entertainment for the other kids. And it imposes sort of a discipline. You have to start dealing with other people in a positive way and being positive rather than negative, adding something to the equation, not just taking. And it is good to preparation for the film business. You end up being in a situation where you're kind of the unwanted guest in a lot of groups.
What's the difference between being a date and being an escort? I don't really understand the process, so maybe you can describe it a little
bit. Well, a girl
would
call, and I had a friend who was in the same orbit I was, and so girls could call either him or me and ask if we'd be their escorts, because normally there are two guys and one girl. And sometimes it was a mother who would call and say, would you be my daughter's escort to such and such a party? Or sometimes a girl would call, and we'd be sort of a package deal. We'd go sort of together. And it created this feeling of social life in a group where we're all there as friends, and we weren't stuck with each other. There wasn't sort of the identity crisis that we're committing to one person for this evening. We were all there together, and I think a lot of these outdated social processes had their charms and their virtues. And it's kind of amazing that they continue so strongly in those places where they existed before.
What were the sexual expectations if you were an escort? Did that mean that you were going to have a passionate kiss goodnight or not?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
No, I don't think you would.
Right. So although kind of like sexual, kind of like fears and insecurities around first dates wouldn't exist if you were an escort, or wouldn't exist as much.
Absolutely not. No. And once I went in a situation which was not like that, and it acquired the atmosphere of a first date and sort of a blind date, and that wasn't so good. But normally, I think that group feeling really was positive. And of course, as represented in the film Metropolitan, after the sort of dances week, there was orgy week, and that was the week we hung out together in people's apartments when there weren't parties, and that's when things got passionate.
Right. You didn't start making movies until you were, I think, in your mid or late 30s. And I'm wondering if you tried different types of writing before you tried making movies.
I did, and I was really in a trap because nothing quite worked. I gave up writing so many times. And I only came back to it with the idea of getting a cheap script to direct so I could prove myself as a director and maybe get other directing jobs later.
Yeah, and Metropolitan was really cheap. How much did that cost?
Well, it started out, the dream was to make it for $50,000, which is...
outrageous.
And then it, of course, creeped up from there.
Uh-huh.
And I think that to get it out of the laboratory cost $230,000, and then we paid about another $70,000 in deferments.
What were you trying to write when you were writing fiction? Books or short stories?
Well, my first career path was to follow my father into politics, to be a lawyer and work in Democratic politics. I became disillusioned with that and infatuated with novels such as F. Scott Fitzgerald, and I wanted to write Fitzgerald-esque novels and tried to write fiction in college. Then I became more interested in humorous short story writers such as Isaac Bashevis Singer and J.D. Salinger and novelists like Jane Austen. And I tried to write humorous fiction. It was terribly limited because I'd always have a comical, ridiculous first-person narrator, and I have to just sort of invent an apparatus for introducing this person and then have them tell the story, which is terribly limited and sort of precious. I hated description. And to try to make description interesting, I'd sort of write parody description, which became sort of intense and overwritten, occasionally funny, but impossible to read. And it was a huge release to find the comedy screenplay format where every character is a ridiculous first-person narrator, and they're going to be played by actors who are going to be up there on the screen and have to take most of the blame. And that you can have a lot of non-sequitur and jumping around, and you don't have to describe anything. The camera does that. So it released a lot of my inhibitions, but it still takes me about 2 or 3 years to write one.
Well, I love the kind of dialogue you write, and I was thinking that in some ways you're the opposite of David Mamet, whose dialogue I also love, in the sense that he gets to how people speak by kind of paring it down to its essential music, you know, to its like minimal music. And he also writes for very streetwise kind of characters very often. And your writing gets to how people speak, but you do it by writing more elaborately than they speak. Instead of stripping it down, you're kind of adding on to it. You're adding like more words and more descriptions than any articulate person could possibly pull off in real life. And I think, and it's also very entertaining, the dialogue you write. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to dialogue?
I don't know. I try to have it all talkable and like people talk. I think the objective is naturalism, to be truthful. And I guess I know a lot of people who talk that way. And I was really pleased.
Kind of hyper-literate people?
I don't know. Maybe they just take phrases that they've read and plump them into sentences and form their sentences that way. I guess that the problem is what takes it from naturalism to something stylized is that there's so much material I like to get in the movies. There's so much to be said, to be discussed, and that does change the realism of those scenes, I guess.
Well, Whit Stillman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Whit Stillman recorded in 1998. He's just adapted his movie, The Last Days of Disco, into a novel called The Last Days of Disco with Cocktails at Petrosian Afterwards. We'll be right back.
Coming up, Christopher Guest, co-writer and co-star of the heavy metal spoof This Is Spinal Tap. This is Fresh Air. The high volume and low originality of many heavy metal bands and the big egos and sexual appetites of the musicians were spoofed in the 1984 mock documentary This Is Spinal Tap. The film is back in theaters, and new expanded editions have been released on DVD and VHS. Christopher Guest co-wrote and co-starred in the film as guitarist Nigel Tufnell. In this scene, he's showing off his guitar collection to the director of a documentary about the band.
Do you actually play all these, or?
Well, I play them and I cherish them. Mm-hmm. This is the top of the heap right here. There's no question about it. Look at the flame on that one.
Yes.
Look, I mean, it's quite unbelievable. This one is just, it's perfect. 1959, you know, it just, you can, listen.
How much is this?
Just listen for a minute. Sustain, listen to it.
I'm not hearing anything.
You would, though, if it were playing, because it really, it's famous for its sustain. I mean, you can just hold it.
Well, I mean, so you'd have to pull.
You can go and have a bite. No, you'd still be hearing that one.
Yeah.
Can you hold this a sec?
Be sure.
This is a top to, you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, 11,
and most of
11,
and then amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you know, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Christopher Guest is a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. So are his Spinal Tap co-stars Harry Shearer and Michael McKean. I spoke with Christopher Guest in 1989 and asked him how he developed his Spinal Tap character, Nigel Tufnell.
I had spent time in England. My dad is English, and although he's not that kind of English. And I'd been playing music with Michael McKean for many years in bands in New York and elsewhere. And I started developing this guy, I guess, in the mid-70s and fooling around with the idea of playing somebody like this. And then when I was living at this hotel in Los Angeles when I first moved out there called the Chateau Marmont, I saw a band arrive. I was standing at the desk for some reason, and this heavy metal band showed up to stay there. And there was a great scene that sort of prompted this whole movie for me, which was the bass player couldn't find his instrument. They were checking in, and the manager said,
"You know, where's your bass?"
And he said, "I don't know. I think I left it at the airport."
You left your bass at the airport?
"Yeah, well, I don't know where it is, do I?" And this was played out of about 15 minutes where he was in such a daze, he didn't even know where his instrument was. And it was this, I got very inspired by that little moment of pathos, I guess.
I want to play a very short clip from the movie, and this is part of the film where the director, Rob Reiner, is interviewing you.
Do you feel that in collaboration with David, that you are afforded the opportunity to express yourself musically the way you would like to?
Well, I think I do, you know, in my solos. Yeah. My solos are my trademark.
Hey,
Well, that's a great solo you're playing there. Did you do your own music for the film?
Yes, we did. That was played live, in fact, at a venue. I think it was in the Valley. We shot at a number of different theaters. Yes, Michael McKean and Harry Shearer and I wrote all the music and played it and produced the album subsequently. And then we went on an actual tour of America after the film had come out. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
What were some of the stadium rock gestures that you knew you wanted to get in your character?
Well, I mean, we went to see a bunch of heavy metal bands, and we actually started playing around L.A. even before we started shooting the film, just to see what that was like. And they're rather limited. I mean, this isn't, you know, like a repertory company thing happening here. I mean, it's either you're shoving your fist in the air or you're grabbing your groin. It's kind of one or the other. And you turn around and you kind of moon people and you stick your tongue out. And it just kind of comes naturally when you're standing in front of a lot of people. The last gig we played was in Seattle. There were 15,000 people. And then it was that weird thing where the line is now being crossed into reality because they were screaming and jumping up and down. And we thought, well, is this real now?
Did you ever study music?
Apparently, yeah. I went to the High School of Music and Art in New York City. I studied classical music and eventually started getting into country music, the natural progression, of course, from studying clarinet. I started playing the mandolin, and I played guitar with Arlo Guthrie because we went to the same school. And then I started playing in bluegrass bands and then rock and roll after that.
Well, I guess that diversity gave you the kind of background you needed to write all the song parodies for National Lampoon that you wrote.
Yeah, it did. We did some country music, some rock and roll, and it did. I really felt secure in a number of different kinds of music that I felt I could do that. And that was a great opportunity at the Lampoon because we had our own studio, and every week for the radio show, which ultimately was made into albums, we could do new material.
You've done so many parodies of rock songs and rock bands. Did you ever have a fantasy of being a rock star yourself?
I don't know. Maybe very early on, maybe when I was, 15 or something. I guess when you're playing in a band, you must think that. But I also remember thinking, the Beatles had come out and I was just starting to play, and I remember thinking, well, there's just no way. I mean, this is just too hard to follow here. And I'd always done funny things, I suppose, or comedy in some sense, even from when I was small, and it just naturally evolved that I was going to combine that with music. So that just then had its own life, where I would combine two things I liked, playing music and comedy.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Christopher Guest recorded in 1989. He co-wrote and co-starred in This Is Spinal Tap, which is back in theaters. New expanded DVD and VHS editions have also been released. Guest directed the new film comedy Best in Show, which is scheduled to open at the end of the month. Our researcher Helen Wong leaves us today. We thank her for her excellent work. But I do have one complaint. Even on days when I thought my interview prep would be easy, believing my guest was too obscure to have had much written about them, she managed to dig up plenty to read, so I was left with no easy way out. Thanks, Helen. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
All the Way Home takes...
the railroad track, and I'm waiting for that train to bring her back. It's not on the 519, then I'm gonna know what sorrow means, and I'm gonna cry, cry, cry all the way home, all the way home,
all the way home,
all the way home,
all the way home.
Yes, I'm gonna cry, cry, cry all the way home. Said. And he could not get it through his old way.